Dr. Alan Wallace is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. I have often thought, and have for most of my life, what would it be like to be a human before agriculture, before all the things that have sort of set us on this course? To go back and say, what were we when we were our most essential physicalness in the world? When we were still just hunter-gatherers and had been for a long time and anatomically human for however many years one chooses to count. In a way, as I read Genuine Happiness, I wondered if you weren't offering me a path to know what kind of a creature I am.
I hope so.
And that's not really a distant question from where you just were. It seems that that might be, that there might be people in the world who have thought long and hard about these things to understand what I really am rather than all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if perhaps you were giving me some handles.
Well, drawing in the various books that I've done, drawing from, not, of course, not only my own musings, my own reflections, but really trying to tap as deeply as I can into some of these wisdom traditions of the world. And, of course, the area that I've specialized in is the Buddhist tradition from India, from Tibet. I think it was more than there being great philosophers. Again, that's a way to cast them in a way in our own image. They were more than philosophers, and they were more than theologians. They were also, at the best of times, empiricists.
Empiricists.
But now when we say, and this goes right back to an earlier theme, when we say empiricism, we mean looking outwards. We think of empiricism as what you can see with the five physical senses and then those augmented by and refined with the instruments of technology. And that's what's really empirical, that which is objective, prone to third person, corroboration, and so forth. Well, that's a very limited notion of empiricism. We have a sixth door of perception. We don't even have a word for it in modern psychology, except for one that has basically been marginalized for more than 100 years, and that is introspection. But there's a whole world of experience here, a domain of reality, which consists of mental phenomena. This wide range, this wide swath of mental phenomena, of mental imagery and desires, memories, beliefs, states of consciousness. And it's, to a very large extent, it remains unexplored from a first-person perspective. And so we have excelled in our modern civilization at the third person and the extrospective. But there is this complementary orientation. And the Greeks knew about it. They had a term that we no longer have. And that they had quite a few terms. Eudaimonia is one of them. Genuine happiness, flourishing. We don't really have a word for that. We just have to make up one. But they had a very deep sense. Aristotle did. And they had another term called noitos. And that is a direct mode of perception of non-sensual or non-sensory, non-physical phenomena. But the notion that there's another mode of perception, well, that too, if it's direct perception, direct observation, we should call that empirical. But this is where the great cultures of, number one, ancient Greece, the Pythagoreans, for example, Pythagoreans, the Chinese, the Greeks, the Indians, the Tibetans, they, I am persuaded, had developed over centuries extremely refined means of empirical observation of states of consciousness and exploring deeper and deeper states of consciousness that lie basically over the horizon of modern psychology. Because modern psychology, the cognitive sciences on a whole, have focused almost exclusively on normal people, mentally ill people, and brain-damaged people. And then we've defined the human psyche as if normal is as good as it gets. We as a culture are suffering from what I would call an imagination deficit disorder. What about extraordinary people? Not only people have extraordinary talents and skills, but people have extraordinary hearts, extraordinary minds, extraordinary states of consciousness. When shall we study these people? Better yet, when shall we become such people?
Listening to you, thinking, oddly enough, of Bertrand Russell, who defined more or less modern logic, great intellect, some people like him better than others, Lord Russell. And at some point in his career, he was also a philosopher, said that the only logically consistent view of the world is solipsism. which in a way is a curious variant on what you just said.
Not everybody is familiar with solipsism.
The belief that that only I exist and everything else is just a projection, a creation of my own imagination. And the reason, of course, is that's the only immediate access you have is to your own feelings. Now, you got Bertrand Russell on the one hand defining modern logic, and who argues that this is the only logical way, you know, the most logically consistent way to see the world. And then you've got all this other stuff that you're talking about, and it seems to me that Uncle Bertie comes down on your side.
Uncle Bertie being Bertrand Russell, in case you missed that.
Uncle Bertie, I'm not quite sure I want him in the same bed with me. Maybe in the same bedroom we can talk.
Well, you'd have to be careful. He was a bit of a rounder.
So I understand, yes. So, yes, I'd be happy to chat with him over the dinner table. Solipsism, of course, I think he must have been saying that somewhat with tongue-in-cheek.
Well, he was provocative. I mean,
that's a good thing to be. That's a good thing to be. But number one, when I consider that I had my mother, that I have a mother, actually, I'm happy to say she's still alive. For me to think that she's a figment of my imagination becomes rather problematic logically. Thanks, Mom. You're keeping me grounded here.
Absolutely.
But there is something of who's the handmaiden of whom, and to a certain extent, modernity has made immediate experience the handmaiden of reason. And that is, science is trying to, has been seeking from the time of Copernicus to understand the objective world as it would appear from God's own perspective, absolutely beyond the veil of appearances, in other words, absolutely beyond anything that immediately appears to our senses. What would the universe look like if you were God and had an absolutely perfect objective perspective? Now, that what kind of phrasing, of course, is antiquated since the 19th century. Now, the philosopher Thomas Nagel calls it a view from nowhere. But imagine you were no one and nobody viewing from nowhere. What would the universe look like then?
Which is also essentially Platonic.
Well, it can be interpreted in that way, but...
But I don't mean to distract you, I'm sorry.
But right, but what they're getting at here is that, and this has been a theme of science for the last 400 years, that the way we're going to get to what's really there beyond appearances and independent of appearances is not going to be but just by gazing at appearance more closely, but in fact having appearances be the handmaiden of reason. So who has ever actually seen an electron, a photon? Who has ever seen a gravitational field or an electromagnetic wave? Who has ever seen an electric charge, or let alone a black hole, and so forth? So these are conceptual constructs that scientists, true believers, are believing these concepts really do reflect what's out there, independent of all appearances. So this is one way of having the empirical data be a handmaiden for conceptual constructs, which would be, in the old jargon, conceptual constructs corresponding to what God himself would see. Now, in these more contemplative cultures, like Taoism, like Buddhism, like the Vedanta tradition in Hinduism, and so on, reason is a handmaiden of experience. And this was the case for the Neoplatonics, John Scotus Eriugen in the 8th century, Nicholas of Cusa, one of my heroes, in the 15th century, challenging the authority, the scholasticism of the Aristotelian current going through Thomas Aquinas, and coming back to the immediacy of experience, but beyond any kind of mundane experience, and crucially, beyond reason. That reason, concepts, the intellect, in the modern sense of the term, all of these are handmaidens for the profound transformation of immediate experience, rather than having immediate experience be the handmaiden for developing more and more elegant theories. I think this is part of the imbalance that we're witnessing in the 20th century. Elegant theories, not much in the way of transcendence of immediate experience and the way we are as ethical and potentially compassionate and happy and wise people.
You talk a lot about balance as a really foundational notion. When you talk about it in what sounds a little abstract, as the two of you are visiting the Western tradition of philosophical pursuit and then saying, and there's another way to say it, that alone would offer us some opportunities for some balance in the current time, to not be trapped right by that. When I was in college, we really didn't have access to the Eastern traditions in ways that just plain old college kids could grasp. Mm-hmm. You, a little younger than I, took off and went to really study this stuff. You went to the source.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it just because you were a rock and roller. Having access to these big notions coming out of deeply, very old and deeply reflective traditions gives us more tools to be thinking about these things, including balance, does it not?
I think you've really put your finger on it. Balance is indeed the key. And this is exactly the problem with modernity, is that for all of our excellences, and I'm not against modernity, I don't want to be walking across the country. I just flew from California to Georgia. Would have been a really long walk, you know? So I'm very happy to embrace many aspects of modernity, many aspects of science, modern medicine, and so forth. But we've lost balance. We've lost balance. And so when I envision hypotheses, to use the term you used earlier, when I envision how could we flourish, we as a species, in interrelationship with the rest of the species with whom we share this planet and the environment as a whole, I'm not thinking of returning to some Rousseauian ideal of the noble savage, let us go back and all be hunter-gatherers. I mean, it's not an option, for one thing. And there's no way on Earth that this planet, literally on Earth, that this planet would support 6 or 7 billion people as hunter-gatherers. That's not going to happen. But what I do see as a renaissance, a possibly unprecedented fusion or integration, would be able to maintain the strengths, the beauty, the depth, the acuity of modernity, including modern science and so forth, but tap into our deep wisdom cultures of the East and the West and bring about an unprecedented fusion. Because I'm not just a traditional Buddhist that's wishing I was in the 13th century and wanting just to have that Buddhist worldview without any relevance to modern science. That's not an option for me. I'm either, in terms of Buddhism, I'm either a neo-Buddhist or no Buddhist at all.
But you are Alan Wallace, or at least you give the illusion of being Alan Wallace, who is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. We hope that you'll be with us.
The manifestations.
Indeed. Yeah. We'll be back shortly. Be with us.